Hey, this is Matt Dawson, aka Stay Great Pony Boy, and you're listening to the Master of One podcast. Find out more about me and my work at staygreatponyboy.com.
Welcome to this Sandbox episode of the Master of One podcast, part two for this week. This week we talk to speaker, author, and food and dimensional typographer, Danielle Evans. I'm Andrew, your master of art and design.
I'm Patrick, your master of television and film.
And I'm Luke, your master of toys and games.
So forget everything your parents taught you about playing with your food, because it's time to get this episode started.
I spell words.
So for this Sandbox episode, we're excited to talk to somebody who, if you are in the creative conference circuit, you are familiar with. We are talking to amateur soccer juggler, speaker, author, and food and dimensional typographer. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Danielle Evans to the show.
Yay.
All right. I still prefer fifth dimensional typographer.
Fifth dimensional. Yeah. So before we jump into your Wikipedia page, can you just give us a brief understanding of that food and dimensional deal? Because, just start with your Wikipedia page, because I feel like this is going to be more of a conversation. I really want to know what that means, and I want to get to it as soon
as
possible.
We'll get there.
I'm jumping the gun. I'm putting the cart before the horse, whatever metaphor you want to use. Danielle, let's stop hearing from me and let's start hearing from you. Tell everybody who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is Danielle Evans. I am a food and dimensional typographer, and that means I make lettering out of food and objects. Ultimately, people hire me as an art director, an illustrator, and occasionally a photographer, but I don't recommend it. And ultimately, my work becomes social media campaigns, commercials, billboards, weird stuff. And oftentimes, it smells great. Occasionally, it smells terrible. It's a wonderful job. I'm very lucky to have it. And I'm happy to be here. Nice.
Where are the smells coming from?
Specific? The food.
Yeah. Okay, so when you do the dimensional typography, what is the, like, who's your main clientele for that kind of thing? Who's bringing you in and saying, hey, I want stuff made out of food, words written out of food?
Well, you'd be surprised. When I started this whole thing 5 years ago, I thought, maybe I'll get a couple agencies calling me, maybe some mom and pop places, but instead it was mostly big brands. So, I mean, Target, The Guardian, Cadillac, the Aria in Vegas, Bath & Body Works. I did something for Tobacco Free Florida recently, which is pretty cool. McDonald's, John Frieda. Just all kinds of weird people. So it's not just the food industry, as you would expect. There's also a little bit of entertainment in there as well, some automotive, things like that. So it seems to translate very nicely across all sorts of platforms, because food and objects, yeah, we can use them literally, but they're also fairly metaphorical, as you were trying to demonstrate before.
Go into more depth about what food typography is, because I'm sure there's people listening that have no, I don't know that I had a full concept of it until I go through and look at your portfolio, and it's like incredible, and it's stuff I would never have imagined doing. But what's the definition of it, and what are some examples of how you use food to accomplish this?
Sure. Well, essentially, the idea being that normal people would use a pen or a pencil, maybe paint, brushes to make letter forms. And that's pretty reasonable, pretty cut and dry. And oftentimes those things get vectorized and turned into something like a logo or a social post, and someone wiggles their cactus into frame or a little pencil, and it's very nice. It's like a little scene. But with the work that I do, it is often me going out to the grocery store and shaking a couple crab legs together, trying to figure out which one has the right bend in it, or squeezing a handful. I'm going to make that gesture that looks like I'm boobing, but in reality, I'm squeezing tomatoes at the grocery store to figure out which ones are ripe.
Right.
And then I assemble that sometimes in a vertical space, so that means there will be like wires or foam or things kind of hidden, of course, by the magic of post-production. Or I'll do it top-down on a table or a floor, and I'll be arranging these things. And the idea being that I'm trying to find ingredients that not only communicate directly to what I'm saying, but also kind of underline various meanings within the message at hand. So sometimes you're going to have something that might say spicy, and oh, it's made out of peppers, and someone will go, don't sneeze, and you go, never heard that before, thanks. But then other times it's about something a little bit more intelligent or more complex. So I've done a couple pieces that were politically themed, and one of them is my favorite. It's a stop motion piece of Cheetos, and they're Flamin' Hot Cheetos, and they say misogynist. And so there's like a hand that strikes a match, it lights into misogynist, wiggles, and then puffs out, and then a little puff of smoke appears. And that was taken from Vox. Vox had called Donald Trump a flaming misogynist. And I thought, what better way? Yeah. What better way to speak to that? Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So how much, so there's actually one piece particular, in particular I was looking at, it's the candy piece you have. It's like all the rock candy or the hard candy. It says snacks and candy.
Yes.
Well, I guess it's not just rock candy. It's all types. How long does it take to sit down and organize something like that? Because you managed to achieve like these perfect letter forms. I mean, like hard edges on everything. The shape is exact. If I sat down to do this, I would feel like I was finished and it would be barely legible.
Well, but she's professional. You're not.
Sure. No, but it almost looks like you're manipulating it beyond just alignment. But this is all just you're taking the time to sit down. So what's the amount of energy that goes into something like that to getting that just right?
It's an immense amount of energy. So when I started working in analog like this, I realized everything takes forever. Okay. It takes forever, yeah. Because you have to plan it like two or three times longer than you would if you were to do it in the computer. You could stick around on a sketch forever in the computer, but ultimately, as you become a professional, you become disciplined and know, okay, it's time to like quit messing with this. It's time to get it finished. I have stuff to do. So in this particular case for me, it can take 2 days of planning, a day and a half of sourcing, and then putting it together can take anywhere from, well, my fastest build was 15 minutes on one of the last jobs I had. And then I've had upwards of like 2 days on other ones. So,
yeah, that would smell terrible by that point. what are the tools of the trade? I mean, is it like a butter knife and like you know, a plastic bag with? It's just that's it. Hands.
Yeah, just hands.
You don't have like fancy toolkit you like flip open and you just have like all these implements in.
Well, I do have like a shitty dop kit back over there. It's got all kinds of blades and things I have to remember to take out when I travel on planes. But it has pins, it has little brushes, but mostly I'm trying to use my hands. And the reason why I have to use my hands is because I've realized if I get too small in scale where I'm using tweezers to pick at things, I'm hating my life because nobody wants to be like this all day. But if I'm working too large, yes, if I'm working too large, then things are cumbersome. It takes forever to move. And I hate my life again. So it's really a question of like, what extreme do you want to hate your life upon? And for me, I'm finding that by working at human scale, everything is more manageable because it's my hands flying around. My arms are creating larger gestural strokes. And so therefore it's a lot more intuitive than one would think working that way.
So I want to know what it's like when you're, because I do like graphic design and I'm always using different fonts and I try to find the right font for the right project and then I manipulate it from there, right? I don't create my own fonts. I'm not a typographer in that sense, but I use a bunch of fonts. How do you go about choosing the right, because this is like hand lettering like to the next level, right? So
yeah.
You kind of have to commit to a font style before you start recreating that font in a three-dimensional space with objects. So how do you go about doing that? How do you go about deciding what the right look for something is before you start actually implementing it into a real-life, you know, setup?
That's also a great question. So I've learned it's kind of a three-pronged process in order to get a project off the ground. The first thing is to come up with what you're going to say. And sometimes that is the first thing that happens. And occasionally that will take a backseat to look at this cool thing I found. I want to work with it. What should I say with this? And so you have to kind of start with either, the technical execution and then finagle a good idea, or you start with a great idea and then work backwards to figure out how to execute it. But then there's finally that third component, which you're talking about, the typographic style. And I've learned that my background is in illustration. I graduated with an illustration degree, so I know how to tell stories. And typically I think about these things as sketching or drawing. So the first thing I'll do if I'm unfamiliar with an object is I'll do a couple test runs. And for example, like candy, I will figure out how to melt it, how to twist it, how to get it in like a crush form, or if there are multiple ways that people use it, like caramel. Caramel comes in like 5 or 6 different varieties.
Sure.
So I'll grab all of them and start like playing with them, trying to figure out which one makes the most sense. From there, I also look at like, what do I want this idea to be? Do I want it to be playful? Do I want it to be sophisticated? And I try to assign it an adjective. Typically, when you learn to draw something, people tell you to envision a word or a couple words that you want the thing to embody. And then you repeat that over and over again to yourself as you're working. So you've got like the verbal assurance, the like the visual red assurance where you're looking at yourself doing it. And then you're actually practicing it while you're working. So you're reinforcing this pattern of, I'm trying to create this sort of thing. So if I want to do like a retro piece, for example, I'll be like, okay, retro pieces, a 70s elongated type. So like long. And I'll try to contrast that with something that's kind of a pokey and very tight in terms of like spurred almost on the serifs. And yeah. So I'll just say that over and over again as I'm working. And on occasion, if I feel really, really stuck, I'll go into like various like images I've saved or books that I have, or I'll go somewhere in town that I know is like used to be an old club, or I'll go through my dad's record collection that he gave me and I'll look for type and I'll try to find one letter. I find that in order to avoid copying something too closely, I'll pick one letter and make a sketch of it and then run away with it and try to figure out how I want to put together the rest of the alphabet based sure. on that one thing.
How you would style everything according to that one isolated...
That becomes your style guide.
Yeah.
Yes, that one component. So there's a lot of room to kind of play with it and make something different. And sometimes I'll come back to my original reference just to see what happened.
Yep.
And it's very different. It's very different. It's like your mind doesn't remember it the same way.
Yeah.
And so therefore you have more opportunity to like build off of it. But if you're married to an idea, like if you are approached by a client, they go, hey, we want you to do this thing. Can you do it? And also we want you to do it in these kinds of materials. And also we want you to say these things. You start becoming trapped by all of those expectations. And so you
yeah.
have to find some way to be like, this is a constant for me. This is something I can control. What are the other things I can be more loose and flexible on?
Sure.
Right.
So when you're doing this, is it all photographed or are you ever doing like installations or pieces in places?
I've done both.
Okay.
I've done both. It's crazy. Both of them have their own challenges.
Yeah.
In some cases, I've had people hire me to do installations where they were to be eaten. And so by doing that, I not only had to figure out how to get the things on the wall, but how to replace them when people inevitably came to eat them.
Yeah.
I had to figure out how to preserve things overnight. I had to figure out how not to break 1,000 health codes.
Yeah.
Maybe we only broke a couple tens of health codes.
Couple of tens.
Well, so I mean, I guess that's another question then is working with food in just, you've said this is like 5 years now you've been doing this. How has that changed your perception of food in general? Just working with it as a object every day. What does that look like for you now?
That has changed so much. I think I had a very small understanding of what food was. I would look at it and I would be like, oh, how utilitarian. I can put this in my face. And maybe I enjoy eating more than most people. That's great. But as I've started looking around, I see that the world around us is full of potentiality. Like we have the ability to assign greater meaning to the things that we touch, taste, feel, and experience every day. And whether we mean to or not, because we're experiencing these things and very actively existing with them, a little bit of that thing is imprinted with us. Mm. So I think there's so many voices in the world around us that we are just not harnessing. And now by using food, I'm like, oh, food has a very political voice. It has a very playful voice. Depending on what you're using, you could even use it in inverse. It could say something about starvation. Mm-hmm. It's just powerful. It's very powerful. And the fact that everybody, I hope, shares the experience of eating makes it even more incredible to use. So it's almost like you're taking these ordinary things and making them just a little bit more extraordinary by adding a typographer's touch to them.
Yeah.
It's pretty dope.
So, okay. So that brings us to, we had a conversation, a little snippet of a conversation when we met you at Crop, and that you talked about just how things, the meanings have kind of been lost, or the original intent of products has changed so much in use. Talk a little bit.
I think
bit
you called it product gentrification. I think that's.
Yes.
Maybe talk a little bit about that idea, because this, I mean, it seems it's a thread weaving here now.
Sure. Yeah, that was a great discussion, by the way. Thank you guys for indulging me on that. I tend to look at, again, using food and objects to say things and how new that concept is. Like, yeah, people have been incidentally messing with pasta for years, or playing with like their food and getting slapped by their parents, being like, "We don't do that in this house." Like that has happened forever. But I feel like the way that we are asking or requiring these items to function now is a little bit more elevated. And so I look back to like the origins of the pencil and the pen. When you look at the pencil and how it came into being, it was strictly blue collar material. Mm-hmm. It was made for someone to make a quick note, something that would probably be covered over or painted or erased. It was something that people used on the fly, and it was scrawly and scrappy and resourceful. And it just had this like different vibe to it. But as pencils have become so ubiquitous nowadays, when you look at them, they're more so a vehicle for an idea. People can make thousands of dollars selling beautiful pencil illustrations. And when I first got into school, I thought that's what I would be doing, is like sketching with pencils and then selling those in galleries or whatever. So the fact being that that voice has been lost because it has been utilized and touched so many times over the last 100 and a half years that it's been around. So it's fascinating to think that these items that are around us, the things in our cupboards, the things in our yards, like, we are really touching them in this way for the first time. So what kind of voice are they going to have moving forward? Will we squelch them? Will we kind of see that in a different way? And you find that paint has had this as well. For example, one of my favorite paintings at my museum here in town, it's an Artemisia Gentileschi painting. And she was one of the like most kick-ass women of the 16th century, the Renaissance period. Her dad was a painter, so she learned to paint. And in this painting, there is a brocade, like a very long cloth of blue lapis lazuli paint. And if you know anything about paint, lapis lazuli was like the gold leaf of that time. So if you were super dope and successful, you could afford to put this in a painting. And if you were painting for some massive patron, like, I don't know, the church, then you could also afford to do this. Sure. So it was a status symbol situation where she's like, check it out. I got this entire like tube of paint that I used on this. Everybody's like, yes. Queen.
Yeah, that would have meaning. That would, in context, people would understand the meaning of that.
Yeah.
And what all, you would have to unpack that a little bit, and you would have to understand that. I think a lot of that gets lost when you lose the context.
Right.
Because then you just think, oh, that has a lot of blue. Okay, cool. But you don't know the history. Right. So what's your, because you're very passionate about this idea, and I think it's great, because it's one that honestly I don't think I've ever thought about. And if I have, it hasn't been to this level. What's the good that can come from that? Because I think we can understand the bad. I think there's some natural understanding of the bad connotations. But what's some good that could come out of being able to write new stories for old things?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I think there's this concept of like revitalization. Lettering in general has gone through a pretty huge revitalization in the last seven to 9 years. I mean, it was a pretty big deal here in my city. My city, Columbus, Ohio, was an epicenter for people who like wanted to come to learn how to write and how to use pen and calligraphy. And they came from all over the place to do this. I don't know what it was about our schools here. That's something I'd like to research more. But it came out of necessity, out of people needing to keep their books well, out of needing to graduate and have certification, because as a country, we were starting to nationalize various certifications for different professions. So we needed things that felt austere and important. And so I think there's a lot of beauty to be had when you look at how we are taking these techniques, these craft practices, and we're imbuing them with life again, particularly the lettering kind of explosion we're seeing, I would say was started by a response to the Steve Jobs design austerity that was going on, this like hyper realistic, super slick, futuristic movement of the mid 2000s, early 2000s, where we suddenly felt like we were lost a little bit, that we got a little too crisp and clean and too futurized.
Sure.
And as we hit the turn of the millennia, we're like, oh, let's look way back. Like, maybe 100 years, that feels kind of safe.
Does anything curl? Were
making their own things and painting their own shit. It didn't look all that great. Right. Let's like go back to that. And so we see ourselves like revitalizing even that trend. And so it's really beautiful to kind of take a paint with all the colors of the wind sensibility to even the idea of letter forms. Because again, you have a word that says what it says. It could even have multiple meanings within that word, just depending on what it is. And then you add in an additional layer of meaning. You add in this contrasting or affirming element of food. So for me, like the idea, one of my first pieces said French, and it was made out of coffee. So the idea was a French press, and it was ground in such a way that you would put it into your French press. I could have just said coffee and written coffee out of coffee, but that's redundant as hell. And you would never write paint out of paint or pen out of pen. Like, you just wouldn't do that. But for whatever reason, that's the first thing most people think of. So
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I've done all of those things. No real artist would ever do that. No valuable artist at all would ever go that direction.
I'm sorry. Too obvious.
That's way too meta. No.
This is
what you're dealing with is a higher level of art. I totally get it. And I don't disagree with you. That's the thing. I'm just recognizing that I have done that.
Yeah.
You say it's a higher form of art, but at the same, maybe I shouldn't tell you this.
Oh, now you should.
And now you feel like you should, yeah.
I've gotten a little bit more politically charged with the work I've done this past year because, again, with the way that things are moving in this country, I feel like you can't be as much in the middle as you might like to anymore.
Sure.
It's just that there's not really a moderate space anymore.
There's not a fence to ride. Yeah.
No. Yeah. No.
So that makes me, that actually bridges to a thing that I'm thinking about with your work. What you do, it's certainly an art form, right? And it is a way of expression, but it is primarily the way that you do it and the way that you commercialize it. It's marketing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are working with alongside these companies and you have strong opinions politically, emotionally, whatever spectrum you want to put that on, you just having gotten to know you over these past couple of weeks, you have very strong opinions. You're very vocal and energetic, not in a bad way, but very energetic and are freely dialoguing with people about things. Where do you draw that threshold where your political and socioeconomic and whatever it is, your views on those things stop and you hand the rest of it over to who you're marketing for and your client?
That's a great question. Well, I feel like there are certain people or certain brands, I should say, that over time have proven themselves to not be aligned with my brand. I was recently approached by one being like, hey, would you like to do a bunch of work? It would probably be lucrative. And I'm like, who are you? And you're like, beep boop. And I'm like, oh, no. No, I would not like to do that.
that's an interesting line to ride, right?
Because like, what if you hated Flaming Cheetos? You're like, I just can't do this in Flaming Cheetos because
I don't want to put them in my body, but I mean, they're great.
But they're a great tool.
Right, honestly. So I think some of it is just figuring out, for me, there's a question of like the truest truth. What is the truest truth that I have that is in alignment with the people I'm working for?
Yeah.
For me, I get in trouble with that when it comes to like banks. For example, I don't like how banks handle credit and kind of, I don't know, shake people for loans and things like that. That's it. I don't like it.
Yep.
And I've been a victim of that with school loans and things. So I am not about it. Smoking is not a thing that I enjoy. I've had people approach me to use processed sugar for children's drinks. And I'm like, no, absolutely not. So there's like levels to this where I feel like my responsibility, as wonderful as my intentions are, if I put this out somewhere, the likelihood of more than not, people will take this in the wrong way. That is a responsibility that I have to make as a human being. Because I do recognize everything that I put out there, because it has an opinion or a flavor or a spin, someone's not going to love it.
Sure.
But
sure.
The important thing is that I'm representing myself well enough that if stuff goes out, the majority of people will know what is meant by it.
I think that's great. I mean, I personally resonate with that a lot. Just the idea of like, even if you aren't specifically working for like philanthropic organizations or nonprofits or things like that, you can still do things in such a way that you are putting good in the world as opposed to putting potential bad back into the world. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's always the hope.
Your outlook and your method for doing that is the way that I would articulate it is just you're finding the good. You called it the truest true, right? That you can. Mm-hmm. That you can attach yourself to, and that's what you focus on. And if you can't get there, that's your threshold, right? That's when you don't work with a product or with a client.
Right.
And I think that's for anyone out there who's listening, whether you're brand new to this or you've been doing this for a decade, that's something that you should hold true so you don't lose yourself in your work. And you can be proud and stand up for what you do.
Ooh, I just read a great poem. Let me get this. This is very applicable. I have this poem. It's by author Rupi Kaur, and it's from the book Milk and Honey. I know that's backwards. But it says here, your art is not about how many people like your work. Your art is about if your heart likes your work, if your soul likes your work. It's about how honest you are with yourself, and you must never trade honesty for relatability.
Hmm. Man,
yeah,
it's like a drop the mic. That's good. Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to
all the snaps.
We have to then pick up after that, huh?
Cool.
Well, on the thread of honesty, there was a I didn't get to make it to Crop, but there was a conversation that happened that I got to hear a little bit about before we started this record, and it has to do with the topic of grief, and it has to do with the idea of creating in the midst of grief. Do you mind unpacking that topic a bit for us?
I would love to. It's weird to be so enthusiastic about something like that, but essentially a couple years ago, I went through a really traumatic experience. I got divorced. I was with my ex for 10 years. We were married for 5, and for a myriad of reasons, it just didn't work. The relationship died. It was so heartrending going through that process, because along the way I had to recognize that this grief could kill my job. This thing that I've worked so hard for, I might not be able to function, and I might not be able to get more work, and I might have to go work somewhere weird at like a call center or McDonald's. And so, but not
hashtag not sponsored.
And so that was really scary, because I felt like so much of my relationship had been wrapped up in the creation of this thing. So much of like our history had been me figuring out if this was even viable. And so it almost felt like a betrayal on top of ending the relationship to do this to my roots. But I realized as I started to process through this and explain this to people, so many designers and other artists out there experience this grief and they bottle it down inside. Like it's all just totally buried. And I don't know how they function except through these really vague tweets and very intense playlists on Spotify. And you're like, so-and-so is listening to my life. Like, for 3 hours. Okay.
Yeah. Between the lines. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. They're reaching out is what's happening in that situation.
Yes. And so it's weird because for the first part of like this process, the healing process for me, I had to be comfortable saying I wasn't well. And I think that's the hardest part of this, is to let people know around you that you're not well. And I had to tell my agent, because he was like, you're traveling a lot and that's super cool, but also, are you poor right now? Because it's been a while since you've had some work. And I'm like, well, I'm going through some I'm sorry. I'll let you know when I feel better. Field anything you can. And at this point, I'm desperate. I'll take anything that comes my way because I just need to be busy. I would write a lot. I started doing therapy. It was so invigorating. And strangely, I did not make any artwork about this. Didn't do that. And I don't know why, but I didn't. Sure. It's almost like I wanted to keep it pure. And that's something where I think when people are grieving, they have to figure out what part of themselves do they want to expose through their work. Because regardless of whether we mean to or not, all of these feelings and emotions are channeled into what we're doing, because our work is it's emotive. It's a very, like, we work in an extremely vulnerable industry. And I know that word is like buzzwordy as hell right now, but it's one of the few industries where we put our hand out and we go, this is what I think and feel. Do you feel this way too? Mm-hmm. Because if so, I need you to grab my hand. And you don't have to do that in accounting or law or anything else, really. And then when people love your stuff, as inevitably they do, especially when it's personal, they reach back and they go, yeah, I feel you. And that's when you know you've like really touched somebody. And we use that kind of emotion to change things and to motivate people. Mm-hmm. And it's really, you can't motivate someone to buy or learn or do or anything to think if you can't get them to feel first.
Sure.
So it's so important to be feeling well.
Yeah. So is this a new revelation to you? Like you said, this has been 3 years. How much alone time or thought time or journaling time or whatever that outlet is for you. How much is this reflection and how much of this was in the moment feeling?
It was a lot. There was a lot of reflection. I would say I took about 6 months off. I didn't think I was ever going to be able to do that. And I made about a third less than I had made in my prior year. It was like on par with like working at a restaurant. That's about how much I made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was something where, because I had had a good year the prior year, I had the opportunity to take a little bit more time than I thought I could. If I had been working in an office, it would be so difficult for me to show up and interact with people. I mean, eventually I think I'd have to get something done, but the people element of it, I couldn't handle. So I was very fortunate to be on my own. However, when it came to like, hey, it's your second week being stuck in bed and it's 12 o'clock and you got to get out of bed, that is when things got a little tricky. So I had to put up fail safes where I texted people every day, letting them know when I was out, like up and well.
Like physically up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'd be like, take a shower. Let me know when you're clean. I'm like, okay, gotcha. Like that sort of accountability.
Yeah.
Cause you're starting from like the beginning, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It was almost like having a stroke where you stroke out and you try to fight it, but you can't. Your body is now restructuring itself. Your mind and your spirit are all like trying to fit it back into your personhood. And so you have to just let that be. And then you learn how to do basic things like get out of bed and shower and talk to people and eat. And then you move on to things like, I can answer some emails today. I'm so tired. You know?
Certainly.
And you just keep going.
The idea of a grief process for everybody, it's completely unique to the person. But if someone has just had one of these kind of like, you know, horizon changing moments, you know, this like life shift, what's a first step? Like is there something that you wish you had done sooner in that process to start reorienting yourself?
I think it would be being kinder to myself. I mean, if you're in this kind of industry, you're probably pushing yourself very hard. You're probably more driven than a lot of people you know. You're probably like very invested in the work that you're producing because it's personal. Again, it's emotive. So for me, being able to look in the mirror and being like, you know, you're doing okay. You got something done today. You talked to a client. You might have to redo the sketches that you sent them because you were sobbing and therefore didn't look at the brief like you should have. But you'll do it again tomorrow and they'll be gracious with you because they want to work with you. So just be cool. And I think that like level of self-affirmation was really lacking at the beginning. But around, I think, the 6-month mark is when I started to be able to look in the mirror and go, you know what, you're doing all right. You're actually really great right now. You're handling this super well. For me, part of that was meditation. I was using Insight Timer. It's a meditation app. It's free. And they had a bunch of them. A bunch of the apps are just people speaking affirmative things to you, talking about how you're actually really great. You're enough. You are talented. You are here with purpose. Like, you're not defined by your work, which was a really big thing I had to grapple with. Like, those sorts of things help to just kind of, like, push and motivate me to be able to get out of bed and do things for fun. And it's funny, like, I did start to recover slowly to a point where I went from this very tight tunnel vision of, am I going to be able to eat in a couple hours? Like, what am I going to do to get rid of this nervous energy? Yep. To like a week out going, maybe I could talk to someone about doing some work for them. Maybe I need to see about a nonprofit if I can volunteer some of this energy and time into a job for them. Maybe I have a friend who just needs some assistance. And so I had to start in this like very like tentative working for the good of someone else, but I wasn't ready to work for me. And then I would get like client jobs while this was coming in. And I was like, okay, I can take some of these. Let's like be just very measured about this. And it's not going to be my finest work. And that's okay. Right. It's okay. And then, and only then, and it took me 6 more months after that, was I willing to do work for myself that I found fun.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I felt like I was healed and I could explore that way again.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that actually brings me, we're going to go into our final question. So we keep it bite-sized for everybody and we don't take way too much of your time.
It's like a food pun this week.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Once in 248 episodes, we hit it.
Cool. anyway, so you said you were able to finally start doing work for yourself. What is the thing that you do that's not your work to like kind of recharge yourself or inspire yourself or give yourself creativity? Because we all need that thing that's not the work we do. So what is that for you?
Well, first, I highly recommend not making all of your interests your job. Because maybe I did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, for me, I like to do a lot of things. I try to do athletic things because it's a different way to burn energy. Like I ice skate, I snowboard when the weather's appropriate. I juggle soccer ball in the park. Sometimes I play with people. I play classical guitar. Nobody has seen me do this. It's just for me.
Cool.
I am.
But you're breaking it out right now.
No,
she's reaching for the guitar right now.
For the first time, everybody, take it away.
That's actually not my obligatory instrument. My obligatory instrument is a ukulele because this past year I was like, Mom, I'm playing classical guitar. I'm going to switch to an acoustic body, which has a smaller neck, smaller body. It should be better for being fast. And she's like, oh, that sounds great, honey. And then for my birthday, she's like, I remembered happy birthday, and I open this box, and it's a ukulele, and I'm like,
wrong.
Love your mom. Maybe she, because you're a petite woman, right? You're not
looks
super tall.
Like a standard.
So she saw that next to the other one, thought, oh, this is the
this
size
is super
right
small.
For her.
She will be so fast. She will be so fast.
I mean, it's like the equivalent of playing the flute and then getting a piccolo.
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So that's fun. So that is my instrument that is strictly obligatory. You could probably beg me to do it with enough time, but since we're running low on time, we'll save that for next.
Fair.
It'll we'll give us a it. Reason to talk again, in the very least.
Right?
I mean, there were other reasons.
Yeah,
because
we don't have like 40 other reasons to talk again.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's whole topics we didn't even get to.
Yeah.
So here's my final question. I want to know, this should be pretty softball. What's your favorite type of food to work with? And what is your least favorite type of food to work with?
Oh, God. Let's start with least favorite. Animal products in general are really tricky. And I've noted like
dead
that
ferrets?
Yogurt... No, like fish. I mean, I've never had the opportunity to work with a dead ferret. I'm sure there's something out there real tricky because I've worked for them a couple times. Yeah, but I've noticed, like, I see a strong correlation between the fact that yogurt goes bad in 40 minutes and a handful of yogurt clients I've had have also been the worst. So there's that. That's very real. But there's a pungent smell that comes with dead animals or proteins that just I wouldn't wish on anybody except maybe my worst enemy.
Yeah. They can handle that.
You know who that person is. I can see it in your eyes. You know who that enemy is.
She was very actively picturing somebody, for sure.
It's amazing.
But I want to know, how tough are letter forms in peanut butter? Because you have that peanut butter sandwich on the top of your site.
Oh, yes. Well, that sandwich is a secret sandwich because it's actually not all peanut butter. It is a foam block that has been carved and also painted in peanut butter.
And a dead ferret.
You're hearing it here for the first time. And a dead ferret. And a partridge in a pear tree. Very interesting sandwich.
Sounds gross. That's
an awful sandwich.
But to be fair, peanut butter hides a lot, so it might be okay.
Well, so maybe along those lines, my question is also food related. Is there a food that, because you have now worked with it, it has completely changed your outlook on consuming it? Like, you were fine with it before, but you worked with it. Now it's changed.
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
I would say... Oh, that's a really good question that I was not prepared for. I think
Don't do that. He's just not, that's he's gonna walk away.
His head
and be like,
is
I
just
asked
growing,
the one question.
Growing.
He's gonna be so pleased with himself. We are not gonna be able to work with him for weeks now.
My God. No, I feel like the way that sometimes I'm hired to use processed foods, so like cookies or crackers or whatever, like Twinkies, Ho-Hos, that kind of thing. When you see how it handles under lights, you realize that the lights are basically replicating the heat in your body when you eat things. So you're watching stuff kind of separate and get nasty and all the oils are kind of seeping out of stuff. Mm-hmm. You're like...
No. Or when stuff.
I don't think I want to do that anymore.
Or when you're taking photos of stuff and it doesn't change, that's equally as bad.
Well, I was gonna say, like, if I worked with a food and I put it somewhere and forgot about it, and like 3 weeks later I saw it and it was unchanged, nothing had happened in 3 weeks.
Oh no!
I'll just leave it alone.
It should also be noted that when I did my McDonald's job, that was kind of like a dream for five-year-old me. Five-year-old me could one shot a hamburger in 3 seconds. The time it took to get out of the drive-thru and go to Girl Scouts, like hamburger gone. I was very proud of this. Yes. And so
that's me.
I'm losing my because I'm like, oh my God, I get to do this for them. I get to do this like for them. This is amazing. It was like impressing my dad, asking me for help. So I go into Papa McDonald's and we're in like the studio area and they go, here are the crispy onions that we put on our sandwiches. And I'm like, oh my God. And I'm just like shoving it in my face. The next morning, totally broken out all over.
No.
It's just like, I don't know how much oil I ate. I was burping all day and I was a disaster. It was so bad. My agent was like, what happened to you? And I'm like, don't eat those.
Don't eat those. Hold on just a second. If they had onions, does that mean they also had all of the, did you have unlimited amounts of McDonald's condiments in front of you? Is that what happened?
I did,
That sounds like a good day.
Some of it was. Yeah.
You're saying this in such a way to paint a terrible picture. At least two of the three of us are going, yeah, keep going. Where does the bad thing happen?
What was it wearing?
That's worth the breakout.
Yeah. Worth it. So That's why we grow beards, so you can't see the breaking out.
I wouldn't
know.
So,
right. McDonald's, if you're listening, we're okay with breaking out. We're terrible at doing exactly what you need done, but we will eat all of your food.
Just make sure there's a condiment bar.
I think they'll just refer you to a restaurant then. Just buy food.
Tell everybody where they can find you, where they can follow what you're doing, they can support you. And like, we already know we're going to have you back because we didn't talk about any of your speaking stuff or written stuff, or we didn't get to see you play the ukulele.
Or so sing? Just you have a beautiful voice, right?
I thought you said skiing. Like, we didn't watch you ski.
But, I do have videos.
But tell everybody where they can follow you and they can find you.
Absolutely. Well, you can find me at marmaladeblue.com. The blue is spelled B-L-E-U-E, as one would say. It's the French feminine. Mm-hmm. So you can find me there. You can find me at Marmalade Blue on Instagram, Twitter. I'm not really on Pinterest, but all of my mom's friends are. You can find me on Medium. I'm M-B-L-E-U-E. And if you are interested, I have opened up my consulting again. I like to sit down with people and talk to them about pitching jobs, help them do that. I like to look at their portfolios and assist them with getting into the right markets. And I've also done some consulting with corporate entities, trying to brainstorm ideas or just get things moving because sometimes you get stale in your business.
Sure.
So absolutely. You can find that at marmaladeblue.com/consult.
Awesome. Nice. Well, you are endlessly fascinating and totally fun, and I'm so glad that we were able to chat, and I can't wait to talk again. But before you head out, will you help us pick our tokens for next week?
Yes.
Awesome. Yay. All right. Well, that's it for our
three. It's backwards.
Yes. No, it's fine. It flips it back for us. We're fine. It's good. That's it for the interview portion. Up next, we're going to draw some tokens. Tokens portion every week is when we figure out the categories we will have the following week, and then we pick our topics based on those categories. That's how it works. I've got the three tokens right here in my hand. I'm going to put them face down on my desk. I'm going to shuffle them up. You're going to give me a number between 1 and 3, and you'll be picking for Patrick. Go for it. 3. Patrick,
unsurprisingly.
Spoilers.
You have art and design.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Oh, God, right. I'm sorry. That's the worst one.
I just saw TV and film. It's been months.
That's sad. all right, so you have 1 or 2, and you'll be picking for Luke.
Oh, I didn't make a little number for that, but we'll go with 2.
2. You got TV and film.
Nice.
That means I have toys and games.
That's the one
games.
I wanted. What's the deal?
I'm sorry. Got it.
Yeah, you did great. I don't know what the
I love
fantastic.
This.
Yeah, go check out Danielle's stuff. She is fantastic. She's
you've
super
seen her stuff.
Fun.
Chances
and,
are you've seen it already.
If you, what
you've seen it already, chances are you've seen it already. You'll see
know,
stuff and
go,
be like,
go
"Oh, that's her. It's
it.
Fantastic."
Yeah, just go look at it right now, and I guarantee you this is not the last you'll hear of her on our show, unless she hated this experience, but I know she'll get an invite back. But you can find us and all the stuff we talked about on mf1podcast.com. If you're watching this on YouTube, all the links will be right below us. But hit up the website, mf1podcast.com. You can also support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/mf1podcast. Throw a couple bucks in the proverbial bucket. It helps us out a ton. We get to do stuff like this and get to do even more stuff because of our patrons, and we're super grateful to them. You can also support the show by rating, reviewing, liking, subscribing, following, all the things that happen on the internet that you do each and every day. Do that, but with our stuff. That's super helpful. It costs you nothing, it is very, very beneficial to us. That rating and reviewing on iTunes is crazy, crazy helpful, and it's probably more than you would ever understand. I don't even fully understand why, but it is very, very helpful for what we do. So if you're a longtime listener of the show, or you're new to the show and you've not yet rated or reviewed, go ahead and do that. Take a few minutes. It would help us out so much. You can also buy some stuff. Go to shop.mf1podcast.com. Get some swag. That supports the show, and you get something that you can wear on your body, which is always good to have stuff on your body.
It's good advertising. I like it.
We're at mf1podcast all across the different platforms. Join the conversation at mf1podcast.com/family. We're going to get out of this episode now, though. I'm Andrew.
I'm Patrick.
I'm Luke.
I'm Danielle.
Peace out.
Bye.
Hold on to your butts.